Hello, listener. You have just made the brilliant decision to select an episode of the Gist podcast. Scroll down the page a bit and click the play button. And we thank you for that. I'm Josh Marsh here with Barry Robertson, and we hope you will enjoy joining us today, or tonight, or whenever you happen to be tuning in, for a very special episode. For you see, listener, this is our 8th podcast episode, and in that sense, you are privy to a very unique and exclusive event, for there will never, ever be another 8th podcast in this series for as long as the universe exists. And if you are listening on or around Wednesday, November 19th, 2014, then you are one of the first, or perhaps even the first, person to listen to this podcast.
Congratulations. Now, for our third science bite, we met up with Dr. Jennifer Corns, a philosophy researcher from the University of Glasgow, who took us on a trip deep inside our own minds to discover the value of suffering.
Yeah, so I'm the postdoctoral research fellow and the project manager for the Value of Suffering project. And the project is a 3-year investigation that has 3 phases. So we sort of want to look at affective experiences from a couple different perspectives. So affective experiences are experiences that feel good or bad. So that's the suffering bit. And it mostly focuses on suffering, but we'll do a bit on pleasure and that sort of thing in the last phase of the project.
And you're at the early phase just now, you're at the first phase or the second phase?
Yeah, so we've just finished the first phase and we're moving into the second phase. So the first phase was focused on the role that suffering might play in rationality. So both how bad experiences or suffering experiences give you a reason to do something, like take an aspirin, don't just cause you but give you a reason. And also how you might have reasons to suffer. So for thinking about that, we sort of looked at the placebo effect and these sort of things where it looks like actually sort of cognitive states and really sort of high level stuff. So what you believe and what you think can actually affect how you feel in ways that are pretty sort of powerful and matter for medicine. And we'll focus there on suffering's valuable functions. So ways that it might be actually helpful to humans to suffer. So it sounds kind of weird, I think, initially to say it's valuable to suffer. But most obvious way it helps you is it motivates you, right? So if you put your hands, think about it, you put your hand on the hot stove, that nasty bit of the experience seems to be intimately related to the motivation to get your hands off the stove. And actually, there are people who don't seem to have that nasty bit, and they have a really hard time learning how to take care of their bodies, and they often die very young. So that nasty bit actually seems protective in lots of ways. So one thing we want to do during this phase of the project is look at not only how that motivational bit works, but also other benefits that there might be to suffering that sort of get neglected and have been overlooked. So like the role in learning and whether you could get the same kind of learning just with positive experiences, or actually whether you need the negative experiences for certain kinds of learning, or how that might affect the learning rates and how that gets mapped sort of neurologically are things that we're interested in this project. And any other sort of, those are 2 functions, but any other values that suffering might have for us. So that's what this phase is about. So that first meeting will be in January, and then we'll do a meeting in Germany. April. That'll be in April, and we're looking forward to that. And then we're going to partner with Leeds and do a meeting in Leeds in May, where we'll focus more on the religious side of things. So there'll be philosophers of religion there who will talk about how these good benefits that suffering have, what they might be able to tell people who are interested in things to do with the problem of evil, right? So why, if there is a God, we might have these terrible experiences.
Bad things happen to good people.
Exactly, that's it. So we'll have a meeting about that. Less science there, I think. But still, I think goes to show how interdisciplinary the topic is and how many people are sort of interested in some of these results and how we should think about these things.
How are you researching it? What is the research method? And how do you value suffering?
Yeah, so it's based in philosophy. Which is where we are today. So the core team is a group of philosophers. So myself and Michael Brady and David Bain and Abraham Cordoba is our PhD student. So it's based in philosophy, but we have a wider team that includes neuroscientists and psychologists from all around the world. So one in Oslo and one in France and one in Australia. And then some philosophers of religion and that sort of thing who look more at the value sort of side of things. But the neuroscientists and the psychologists are doing all sorts of experiments related to suffering and the nasty bit of suffering in particular. So that's what we were talking about before. So we sort of call that the hedonic tone. That's this nasty bit of suffering. and how it works and interacts with these other sort of mental states.
Hedonic tone is a sort of scale for the quality and extent of an emotion. So you can think of anger as having a very negative hedonic tone, whereas general happiness would have a positive tone.
Would you like to tell us a little bit more detail about why you're interested in the limbic system?
Yeah, I can do. So some neuroscientists, psychologists, philosophers, for that matter, a lot of people at this point were coming out, I think we are coming out of it, but a period where affect, so the sort of stuff we were talking about before, the sort of immediate hedonic impact of things, I think people for a while thought we sort of had that figured out to a large extent by thinking, well, it's the limbic system, basically. And I think a lot of research in the last 10 and 15 years, but maybe especially the last 10 years, I think has been sort of debunking that in a way and showing that things are a lot more complicated than I think we had realized. So there doesn't seem to be, for instance, a single pleasure center, which people thought there were for a while. There doesn't seem to be, and this I think people have been more hip to for the last 20, 30 years, a pain center. Just doesn't work like that. So actually, much, much more of your brain, for instance, is involved in pleasure experiences, but also pain experiences. And the limbic system itself seems to be more complicated than people had realized in a couple ways. For me, the most interesting ways are things that, given the stuff we talked about before, it won't be surprising maybe, but the sort of downstream effects onto the limbic system for me are the most interesting. So not just how things get projected upwards, but how things get projected, as it were. I mean, these are rough terms, up and down, but from other higher, quote-unquote, areas back down, and how those projections get received and alter the functioning of the system itself. I think some of that's going to be key to us figuring out, you know, what's going on in these experiences. So that's why I'm kind of interested in the limbic system. But it's certainly no longer like, I mean, I think 50 years ago, maybe that's too long. Anyway, 30 years ago, people, I think, kind of thought, well, the whole action for these affective experiences is going to be happening in the limbic system. And I think kind of nobody thinks that anymore. We're sort of understanding it just kind of doesn't work in this sort of boxy kind of way. You can't just box off the limbic system and go, oh, it's happening there. So, but it's still very important, I think.
This part is a bit difficult to conceptualize. Essentially, the prior view held that pain functioned as a sort of black box in the brain, sort of like a circuit or logic diagram with multiple inputs affecting the output of the pain center. Jen's view is that you have to take that black box and break it apart into its component pathways.
So, kind of to summarize with the models that you were talking about, is with the feed-forward model, you kind of have pain, and then you have the ow feed forward into pain, but what you're talking about is there's that ow feed forward into pain, but also additional inputs coming down from sort of cognition and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Is that kind of what you're saying?
So the way you put it makes it seem like the ow is the pain. So the pain is still coming from something like nociceptors or something, and then you have the pain experience, and then the pain experience is subject to these downstream effects. And I think a lot of people would be happy to put it that way. But I think a lot of other people, and I guess I'm among them, have really been questioning the idea that there is this thing in the middle that we should think of as the pain experience, as opposed to the pain experience being this actual complex. So that, well, one part of the pain experience is that information getting processed about particularly noxious stimuli. Another part is this evaluative bit. That's actually just as much a part of the pain as the nociception. So that's exciting. I mean, philosophy can be, I think, at the interface of some of these other disciplines. But I think to make progress on suffering anyway, we need that interdisciplinary stuff, right? It's no good to just, as I think all good neuroscientists and psychologists know, right? It's no good to just run the experiments. You got to know what you're looking for, right? And that takes theory. and so the interdisciplinary exchange, I think, is crucial. Which, if you think about, you know, what philosophy is doing ultimately as far as trying to figure out what's true and create an overall picture of the world, if you believe in the scientific method and you think that science is telling us about the world, then it would be silly not to take that into account in your theories of whatever it is you're theorizing about. If there's scientific data that's relevant, you should go find out what it is if you want to say what's true about that thing. Sorry, that was a long-winded answer to that question.
Because of the interdisciplinary nature of Jen's project, the possible implications are fairly wide-reaching.
So it's not clear whether or not fish feel pain. And, you know, from my perspective, given what I've said before, you might guess, right, I think that, in a way, that's the wrong question. We know that fish have something like damage detection, that everyone should be granting that, right? They process information about noxious stimuli, and they respond to that information in a way that is evolutionarily, you know, kosher, good, for the most part.
It's kind of like machines, just...
Well, yeah.
Okay.
I mean,
is that the model that was kind of older, is what you're talking about, where it's more just a response?
I think we should at least grant that they have that, yeah. So maybe it's more complicated than that for the fish, which is where then the controversy comes in. So I think we should agree that they've got nociception, right? If you like nociceptor talk. And then there's a lot of controversy about whether or not they have the suffering bit, right? So the unpleasant bit. And a woman who was involved in the Pain Project, so the Pain Project was the predecessor to the Suffering Project. And when we did the Pain Project, this biologist named Victoria Braithwaite, who's maybe the leading biologist on fish pain, she wrote a book called Why Fish Feel Pain. It was a huge success and has been really influential. Came and we were talking and she was sharing some work. And her and I had long conversations, fruitful, I thought, and interesting conversations about whether or not fish suffer, because I tend to think they don't, and she's been a big pioneer for the idea that they do. So we had these long conversations, and she was giving all these experiments about their cognition, right? So she was talking about different kinds of fish, and it's actually really important that there are many, many different kinds of fish, right? So what we say about one shouldn't necessarily cover them all. There's a crap ton of species of fish. And she thought that these experiments that had to do with cognition, so all these complicated things that different kinds of fish can do in ways that they can learn. So some fish seem to be able to learn rudimentary logic. Really interesting, actually. Those experiments are great. I highly recommend her work, actually. Victoria Braithwaite, she's fantastic. And she thought that this was evidence that then they suffer, right? Because look how sophisticated these creatures are, right? And I said, well, I don't... They could be really, really smart and not feel anything, right? So we had these long conversations about what sorts of behaviors would be evidence for, because obviously we need behaviors. The fish can't talk, at least not in a language we can understand. So what sorts of behaviors would count as evidence for social, for feeling? And we settled on, in agreement, sort of social behaviors, I thought, right? So if they look like, if fish kind of bond and then the one dies, you could look for sort of grief behaviors, I think, that would be sort of telling, or sort of cooperation that made it look like there was some sort of empathy or affect going on in the interactions with other animals. I think that would be some evidence. Wouldn't be settled, it would be some evidence. So she was here for a workshop. We had these long talks, and then she came back in the summer for the conference, which was sort of the culmination of a bunch of workshops that we had had. And she said, the last time I was here, Jennifer said, we want evidence about social bonding. And now I've got this evidence about social bonding. And she had went and run these experiments about what looks like social bonding among, anyway, a certain kind of fish. And that was really exciting. So that's an example, I think. I wasn't convinced by the by the data in the end, but we had more fruitful talks, and that was really helpful. So that's for me. But I think that sort of thing happens, you know. Hopefully, if people are really talking, I think that sort of thing happens, you know, more and more.
Here's another example where Jen is discussing the implications of breaking apart the black box.
So, and the reason I think that's of benefit is if we think that there's this thing in the middle of the pain, then we go looking for it, right? And we try to develop drugs that target it, and as opposed to, I think, something that I'm hoping anyway in the future might help, is to break the experience apart into its pieces and figure out for different people in their different experiences which bit it would be most helpful to target. Because our painkillers right now, you know, are pretty rudimentary. They just sort of knock out whole systems, basically. They're not targeted.
So fish feelings, neuroscience, and drug targets.
Oh my!
Thanks for listening, Gisters. If you have an interesting topic in mind or would like to interview with us, then please email us at editor@the-gist.org.
Until next time. Oh my, it was entirely too camp.
Go ahead. Oh my.
Oh my.
Oh my.